Welcome once again to another episode of Demand Gen Radio, the one program that brings you all the latest methods and technologies for driving growth and increasing demand. With the voice of Demand Gen, David Lewis.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of Demand Gen Radio. This is your host, Dave Lewis. Today on the program, as you guys know, I like to deviate from a lot of our normal content tracks where we're talking about the methods and technologies for driving growth and having a lot of marketing leaders, as I've been having on all these episodes for you guys, hearing about their journey. The reason I want to take a pivot today, and if you took a look at the title, is I want to bring someone on the program for you guys that just personally, I think, can be tremendously beneficial to you as an individual, maybe even as a leader on your team. Mark Sanborn had a very profound impact on, I would say, my view and my career and just my persona through the reading of his first book. Mark and I never met when I grabbed the book. The book is called The Fred Factor, and it is on the New York Times bestseller, as well as many other bestsellers like The Wall Street Journal. So I just wanted you guys to know, like, today you are in for a treat because Mark is not only a world-class storyteller, but as I said, he can have a very profound impact on, I believe, your career and even your psyche. Just to give you a soundbite, I want to introduce Mark, but the reason that I am so attached and excited to have Mark on the program, which I've never had before, I was telling Mark, like, about, I don't know, a month ago, I was thinking, you know, I like to bring on authors and I like to bring on thought leaders kind of outside our domain to mix things up here. And the very first person that came to mind was Mark. Mark, welcome. How are you?
Dave, I'm terrific. Thank you for the kind words. And it's great to reconnect after we were talking before we started the tape. 6 years ago, I had a chance to present for Demand Gen and on their 7th anniversary. So congratulations on 13 years of growth and bringing value to the marketplace.
Thank you. Yeah, I couldn't believe it was 6 years ago. So we have a company offsite every couple of years. We bring everyone together on the team. And Mark was essentially our keynote speaker. He kicked off the event. And I mean, if that doesn't give you guys a sense of just, again, how much I value Mark and his inspiration and his leadership. Mark, I don't know if you know this. We give a copy of the Fred Factor to every single employee who joins our company. So we've given out, you know, over that 13 years, hundreds of copies. And it's a little bit of a Bible for us in terms of the inspiration and direction that we want to give our team on being extraordinary, because that's what the book is all about. I'll let you talk a little bit about the book, but I, you know, for everybody, this isn't, Mark sold millions and millions of copies of the book. This is not about you running out and go buying the book. I mean, do it if you want, but this is really about introducing you to Mark and the conversation that we're going to have. Fred Factor is all about being extraordinary. And when I read the book, I started practicing what Mark was sharing immediately, and it was completely transformative in my life. It has made me a better husband, made me a better father, made a better teammate, better leader. And so I just really loved, as you know, Mark, what you shared, and thank you for bringing the team. We get to give it to everyone because our brand and our company, we don't want to be ordinary. We want customer service to be absolutely exceptional. We're in the services business, so we are the product. And your inspiration and your direction about us, you know, being at the very top of our game has always been helpful. Before we talk about leadership and some of the other dynamics happening in the world today, Mark, that book you wrote long, long time ago, where does it sit with you? In you know, you've written so many different books, and I wonder, because I'm so attached to it and the advice you gave and how transformative it was for me, are you still connected to it in that way? Or have you emotionally moved on and in your leadership moved on from what you were sharing years ago?
I'm very much still connected with the Fred Factor, and I'm actually still connected with the centerpiece figure, a postal carrier named Fred Shea. He has since retired, but we periodically will try to have dinner with he and his wife, Kathy. I was at one of his son's wedding receptions, and we've become friends. And of all the books I've written, when I wrote that book, I had no idea it would be a bestseller. And I know it would be inspirational to say I had, you know, a dream board and I visualized bestseller status. I just wanted to write a really good book about an ordinary guy doing an extraordinary job. And frankly, as an economist by training, not that I practice the bleak art of economics, I knew that the odds of ever writing a best-selling book were minuscule. I mean, they're just not good odds. So I was gratified when the book took off. And I think the reason why, a number of reasons why the book was so well received. The first was it wasn't about, you know, Bill Gates or Warren Buffett or Larry Ellison or any of the uber rich, super successful people. Because when you read about them, and certainly there's some instruction you can gain from a biography, but by and large, you go, that's not me and it never will be me. So when you take putting mail in a box, which is effectively what Fred Shea did for me, and you make it artistry, it proves the point that none of us have an excuse to be ordinary. Now, you can't make people be extraordinary. And I love when I'm asked, you know, can you make someone be a Fred? And I used to say, I couldn't make, when my boys lived at home, I couldn't make them take out the garbage. So no, I don't think you can make somebody do something they fundamentally don't want to do. However, I hope that the book has done two things. A, I hope it's made people aware of the fact that we all have ordinary moments that we can turn into extraordinary by choice. And number two, a message that was in the book, but it wasn't fleshed out, but really has become the underlying theme of all my books since, is that nobody can prevent you from choosing to be extraordinary. Mm-hmm. You know, you may not work for a company that encourages or rewards it. As a matter of fact, unfortunately, a lot of people grew up in an environment where they were discouraged, you know, or they tried to stand out in a positive way, and a classmate or a colleague or a boss, you know, took advantage of that and discouraged them. So I think it sounds a little melodramatic, but I think choosing to be extraordinary is almost an act of bravery today, because we live in a world where, you know, in the Japanese culture, there is a saying many years ago that the nail that stands out will be pounded in. And that basically talked about conformity and being, you know, average. So, you know, by telling the story about Fred and then relating the four principles of the book, it's absolutely the most gratifying part of 33 years as a speaker and author, is when I hear feedback like you were nice enough to share, or I find out, as I did a few years ago, that there was a hospital, a medical center in Frisco, Texas, that on their 10th anniversary, they invited me to speak, and they had actually used the Fred Factor pre-groundbreaking to help design their culture. And, you know, I got to tell you, Dave, it's always nice every once in a while in the old days, pre-COVID, pre-plague, when I would do a book signing, someone would come up and say, you know, your book changed my life. Your speech changed my life. And I said, no, my book didn't change your life. And I didn't change your life. You changed your life. I'm not a miracle worker. I'm not God. But it is nice to be able to give people the tools and the motivation and the inspiration that they can use to change their own lives. And that's kind of what, you know, my calling is as an author and speaker.
It's so you to say that. And I think what we're all saying and feeling when we're doing that is you gave us a recipe to find what we were maybe wanting to be. For those of you that haven't read it, and by the way, it's one of those books that you can plow through. I was going to say on a flight, but none of us are flying.
Actually, you can read it before you push back from the gate.
Yeah, for sure. It's a great storybook. Fred was Mark's mailman. And the story, I won't take too much away from it other than to say Fred was an extraordinary mailman. He wasn't the guy that just put mail in the box. And so Mark's book, which I love what you talk about, like if I read Warren Buffett's book or Bill Gates' book or whatever, if I want to be like Warren, I'm not going to be like Warren. I mean, he's one of the richest guys in the world. Whatever's written about him, it's pretty hard to become Warren Buffett, if not impossible, right? But you, through a series of stories profiling Fred, gave me the recipe to be an extremely kind, extremely generous, extremely thoughtful person every single day with every single person that I meet and want to have that relationship with. And Mark, your recipe is still paying dividends. It's you know, it's become who I am. And that Lily, I hope she's hears this podcast, but she just celebrated a birthday. And she, her manager said, hey, one of our employees has a birthday coming up. She's read your book. She's a big fan. You know, it'd be great for you to, you know, send her a copy. But I didn't do just that, Mark. That's easy to do. I can take a book, sign it, put it. So I made her a video, made her happy birthday video. And picked out some different music and looked that she was from the UK and found, you know, Happy Birthday from the Beatles remix. And we had a good time making this video with Carlos and I and sent her the video, and they played it during their leadership or their management meeting. And then, of course, sent her a book and a whole bunch of other stuff. And it's an instinct, Mark, for me to do those things for people because of the inspiration that you had and just whatever you did in that book to get inside my head to really up my game on just being just a very caring person. So that's how you changed our lives, is that you broke it down in such a way that just lit up something inside of us to say, that's who I want to be. So thank you for that.
Yeah. Well, and you know, one of the things I like to point out is I think one of the reasons why more people don't exemplify the spirit of the Fred Factor isn't a lack of willingness. It's a lack of awareness. You know, we so much are creatures of our environment. You know, when I was in college and getting my degree in economics, my roommate was becoming a doctor. And my degree, by the way, just to be completely honest, is ag economics, which is a very narrow niche within economics, because I'd grown up on a farm. The farm wasn't big enough to go back to, but I knew I would stay in agriculture. So I said to my roommate, I said, how did you decide to become a doctor? And I'll never forget what he told me. He said, well, my grandfather was a doctor, my dad was a doctor, so I knew I'd be a doctor. And here's what's funny. My grandfather was a farmer, my dad was a farmer, and even though I wasn't going to be a farmer, I was going to stay in agriculture. And at the age of 19 or 20, I realized how we unintentionally limit ourselves because we just don't have other examples, right? And it's not bad. It just is the way of the world. So when somebody decides to be Fred-like, it rubs off. You know, Fred rubbed off on me. I wrote the book. I give the speech. It rubbed off on you. You do these things for others. And it's a wonderful kind of positive cascade in a time where the headlines are negative behavior and bad behavior. And I think the most amazing thing, by the way, Fred Shea ever said to me is he said, Mark, he said, I'm gratified the book's so successful, but doesn't everybody do their work this way? And I said, yeah. I said, Fred, if they did, nobody would read the book. But the reality is, no, everybody doesn't do the work the way you do it. But it was so second nature to him. And that he didn't do it because he thought someday somebody will write a book or I can become Postmaster General. He never, by the way, wanted to be promoted. He loved what he did, putting mail in the boxes and interacting with the customers on his street.
We call those people at Demand Gen rock stars, which is the term comes from like they're amazing at what they do and they're a rock. They're solid. They're foundational. That's what they like doing. You know, there's people who work for Ford and other car companies on the assembly line, and that's what they do their entire career and they're really good at and they enjoy it. And there's other people who want to just keep climbing the corporate ladder and keep advancing their careers in the way that they want. Let's move from the fray. And by the way, if you guys want to copy the Fred Factor and it's your birthday coming up, let me change your life. Send me a note on LinkedIn, reach out to me, and I would be happy to send a copy to you. If I can give the gift that Mark gave to me to just one of you or some of you, happy to do that. Really what I'm saying is if you want it and you want to have a personal connection with me, I would love to have that based on Mark's book. The other thing I would encourage any of you to do is by the way, Mark's last name is no D, MarkSanBoron. Google will correct you if you type it wrong because he's so popular that did you really actually mean Mark Sanborn? No, I think you meant Mark Sanborn. So you'll find him, but Sanborn. So go to Mark's site and take a look at his books and his works. Mark, you were speaking all around the world. You have your entire career, and then, quote, this happened. COVID happened. So what are you doing these days to take your knowledge and inspiration and help others?
Well, that's a good question. The thing about COVID is it scrambled everybody's eggs. You know, historically, there have been sectors that are harder hit or sectors that have been, you know, pummeled by circumstance and fate. And, you know, the entire world basically got put in big time out by God to reevaluate our lives and our businesses. And the good news is, even though I'm not a happy talk guy, I think people are surprised that as a speaker and an author, you know, I just don't like happy talk. I'm a realist, but I believe that realism doesn't prevent you from finding the positive and the negative. And a few things that I did is I instantly realized that if I wanted to continue to share ideas in person, not just in books, I better understand digital platforms. and I got a lot better. Now, I'm not the king of Zoom and GoToMeeting and WebEx, but I'm pretty good. And I guarantee I'm about 20 times better than I was March 1st, which is the last time I was on an airplane. I also knew that, and by the way, I've had this conversation with some of my clients and actually with a class of seniors in college. And they said, you know, all of our plans, the seniors said, all of our plans, they wanted to go into hospitality, hotels and restaurants, bad timing for them.
Yeah.
All our plans have been dashed on the rocks of fate. And I said, well, here's what you've got to do. And I'm not saying it's easy and I'm not saying you would have signed up for it. But if you fight the inevitable, that's the fool's fight. You got to look at the reality and say, where is the intersection between the new pain that has been created and my skill set? Well, my skill set was always about sharing ideas. And my favorite way to do it was on a big stage in front of a lot of people and secondarily in my books. So I can still share my ideas. And frankly, I like big stages better than I do little computer platforms. But I get to continue to use and monetize my expertise. And the other thing I thought is I wasn't keen on being a producer of digital content. It's not my strong suit. I mean, I could learn it and I have to a degree, but I collaborated with a buddy of mine that's been my videographer for 30 years. And we started a little business called Livestream Denver. And it's based on the premise that most speakers and meeting planners don't want to produce. They want to present. Mm-hmm. A meeting planner wants to know that if they hire me to speak, that the production is going to be good. And I want to speak and not be preoccupied by the production. So we created a little business where we can provide. We built a stage. We have a huge green screen. We have the ability to do 2 and 3 camera shoots. And I knew that this wouldn't appeal to the masses, but it was a felt need. And Dave, I've always believed that any marketer is better starting with a felt need than trying to create an unfelt need and make it a felt need.
I want to ask you a question about life's journey. I'm for everybody listening in, I wonder how you feel about this. Mark, when I was growing up and I was in my, let's say, late teens, early 20s, I had this personal goal that I was going to retire at 40 years old. Like that was my goal. And the reason that that was a goal and it had a year tied to my age was that I thought by that age, I want to reach a certain level of success. Candidly, I think that meant financially that I'm going to retire at 40 years old. And this morning when I woke up driving to the office, which I go to every single day and have, I've never worked a 40-hour work week. I wouldn't know what that feels like. By the way, I'm extremely balanced, as you know, in terms of family and friends and work, but I love what I do. I don't know why I ever thought that I would want to stop working at age 40, because to me, stop working at age 40 would be, for me, in many ways, stop living, because I love what I do. And you've got to be the same way. You've certainly done well enough in your career that you could retire tomorrow, but you do what you do and are adapting to the environment. And I think for people on the podcast, like right now, some people, they hate their frickin' job. They hate what they do. But to me, that doesn't mean you hate work and working. You hate what you're doing or where you're doing it. And I'm wondering what your perspective is around career and work. Retirement is just, I don't know what that looks like. And yet I really want everyone to enjoy what they're doing in their career. And so many people reach out to me and ask me for career advice. Do you think I should go into this field or in this role or this company and that type of stuff? And I'm always giving them advice. My advice is never like, I think you should stop working. I don't even know why that's a goal or was a goal for me back then, other than I would connect it with being financially independent. I've stayed in the best hotels in the world, the best hotel rooms, driven nice cars, taken nice trips. I mean, but if I did that every single day, I'd be bored as shit. Like, I really, really love what I do. What are your thoughts, for people like myself and you that just love this? And how do we help people who are listening think about where they are at in their journey and what they want to get? Because this is either a year of, you know, I can't wait for 2020 to be over, or this is a year that really gave people a chance to move in a direction that will forever change their life for the better.
We're completely on the same page. And, you know, long before we ever met, when I graduated from college, I knew a couple things. I mean, you know, we all think we're smart at whatever age we're at until we get older, and then we hope we're a little smarter. And the two things I knew was that, number one, I was probably going to have to do some things I didn't want to do so that I could eventually do the things I wanted to do. And I think that's one of the stereotypes that is untrue, that, you know, you can just pursue your bliss right out of the gate and achieve it. Maybe not. You know, living on a farm, I was fortunate because growing up on a farm, nobody ever asked me if I wanted to work. Nobody said, hey, would you like to get out of bed and go feed the calves and bale the hay and put it in the mow? It was like, get up. And that may sound harsh, but it was, in retrospect, the great blessing of my life, because I learned to appreciate work and all that it involved. The hard part, the easy part, the part I enjoyed, the part I hated. So then I knew that, you know, I was probably going to have to do some things I didn't necessarily want to do. So I didn't start speaking right out of college. First of all, you know, I had didn't know a whole lot about business because I hadn't done much business. And I went into sales and marketing. But here was my goal. Here was the second thing I knew. I always wanted there to be no line between what I like to do and what I got paid to do. You know, they say now we got to separate work life and personal life. And I suppose for some people, that's good, but it wasn't for me. I didn't want to wake up in the morning and say, I have to go to work, or it's Saturday, thank God I don't have to go to work. I wanted to wake up and go, I get to do what I like to do today, and I'm going to get paid to do it. Life doesn't get much better than that professionally. But again, it didn't happen right away. It took me about 7 or 8 years, and I started literally working on becoming a professional speaker while I was still in college, because I knew I wanted some aspect of my life, whether I was, you know, an executive or a sales professional, it would involve communicating. But my real desire was someday to be a full-time professional speaker. And I became that some 33 going on 34 years ago. One of my favorite quotes is, I think it was Henry James said, it's time to start living the life we've imagined. And it dawns on me that the biggest problem is most people have never imagined a life any different than they're living. And there's the key. And I'm not talking about, you know, throwing all common sense to the wind and, you know, imagining you had $1 trillion. But it goes back to what I said in college. I never imagined anything but a career in agriculture, right, at the time. And I knew I wanted to speak. And by the way, I was speaking to agricultural groups because I had not imagined a life different than the life that I was living. So maybe it's time for people in this great reset. We've got that opportunity that we either didn't have before or didn't make to say that. So, you know what? Life is short. I'm not going to get to do what I did the same way I did it necessarily. So what do I want to do instead? And the good news is I'm doing a lot of things now that, you know, I'm focusing more on actively investing, which is great fun. You know, before I used and I still use professionals because I'm sure not that smart, but it's just been fun to take a percentage of my portfolio and look at investing in alternative investments. I'm looking now at the opportunity to do some philanthropy and ministry that before I would say, golly, you know, if I take that free speech on Tuesday next month and I get a booking, holy buckets, I just blew a big paycheck, right? Well, now I know where I'm going to be next Tuesday, right? There's no chance that somebody, or very little, although there are a few live meetings coming back, very little chance it's going to displace anything. So I basically looked at the circumstances and said, where can I extract some good things? And the last thing I'll share, Dave, is that COVID gave me the best 6 months of learning I've had in my life since I graduated from college. Because, and I'm an avid reader, I'm a voracious reader. But I really had a chance to go deep and use resources that I invested in and seldom used. And so I'm grateful, not for COVID, but I'm grateful for the blessing of having a chance to have done a deep dive in some things I'm really interested in.
You said some things and I was listening, and I think I found a connection to our passions in terms of why we work. And that is, our work gives us energy. You know, we enjoy the output from the energy that we put in. And I don't think I would I know I wouldn't love work if I didn't get that. All right. Every day, I think about our employees and making careers for them. And that gives me energy. Knowing that I, you know, this week we're hiring a new person to our team on the for the Salesforce group, do a lot of CRM work for our clients, and there's always demand for that. So we keep hiring people in that area. And I think like this guy in COVID just came into a company that when I onboard him, the very first slide I show every single employee is my goal, which is to make this the best place they've ever worked. I said, it won't be your first, may not be your last. Although if you retire here, that'd be amazing. That'd be great. We've had a bunch of people, well, not a bunch, but several people retire. I said, but it'll be the best place you ever worked. That's my goal. That's my commitment to you. And all I ask in return, two things is, one, let me know if you ever feel that way, because I would like to know that. Just, you know, that, and it shouldn't ideally be the day that you're leaving, although it often is, Mark. You know, like someone will say, hey, by the way, Dave, it was the best place ever worked. I know that was your goal and I want to share that. Like, I like to know it along the journey. And then I say to them, and if it's not, please tell me why it's not, what you're feeling that where we can make this a better company, the best company you've ever worked at. When it comes to working with clients, Mark, you know, seeing our clients, I mean, the number one measurement for me on the business is seeing our clients get promoted and advance in their careers. That's my measurement of is what we're doing for our clients working. Yeah, we're helping them grow revenue with their company. I mean, that is what we wake up as a team to do every single day. But what we really care about is, are they advancing in their career? Are they getting promoted? Do they get recognized? Because let's face it, in marketing, someone you know in this background, marketing is not often connected with, quote, success, with revenue. Yeah, the booth looked great. The brochure looks awesome. That new video looks really, really slick. Yes, we're a great arts and crafts department. We know how to make, you know, stuff look good, but that is not what marketing is doing in this day and age. We are driving revenue. We are driving growth. Let me ask you about a conversation that I had with someone. She's not happy, Mark. Client called me the other day. She said, Dave, I hate it here, which is bold, you know, for me to hear that from someone. And I said, why is that? And she goes, I sit in these meetings and I'm not a leader. And I'm sitting in these meetings, I'm a doer. And these ideas are stupid. And I don't speak up. I don't say anything. And I said, well, why don't you speak up? And she's like, I'm afraid to really just, you know, give my input and give my feedback. And she's, you know, very young, very early in her career, first 5 years. And I was really at a loss for what to do until she gave me the answer, which is, she says, I'm thinking about starting my own business. And I'm like, boom, you should do that. You know, like if that's what's going to give her energy and she's ready to do that, you know, especially early on in your career where you have very little risk in your life. How many people feel so unempowered and so in your experience and not able to make an impact that they're a bit of a drone or just there to perform the duties that are dealt with them as opposed to bringing about change? Because I felt like that was such a tragedy that she doesn't feel that she can really steer the marketing programs in the direction that they need to go.
We probably interact and see those people that hate their jobs, but either feel they don't have the freedom or the courage to quit and do something different. And, you know, they work it out on us and our interactions with them, which is sad. And I do acknowledge that there are sometimes circumstances that, you know, prevent somebody from jumping out and starting their own job. But one of the things that I've always shared with clients and the people who ask me for advice, I say, you know, long-term balance requires short-term imbalance. I could tell you stories. I won't bore you with my beginning years as a speaker, but, you know, 1 year I was on the road 240 days and I was doing 6-hour seminars. And it's good that I was young because you need a whole lot of energy to do 6-hour seminars. I don't do 6-hour seminars these days. It's just not what I like to do. But I would say that, you know, people need to know that first, the culture we create is so important. My last book came out October last year, actually a year ago, come to think of it, just before COVID. And I remember right in the middle of COVID, I thought, holy smokes, I wonder if everything I wrote about still applies. And I kind of went back and used this new filter. And I think it applies every bit as much or more. But I talked about three shifts for leaders. And I think you've touched on all three without even knowing it. So I want to connect it. First, we're making the shift from motivation to inspiration. Motivation's carrot or stick. And the one thing I love about millennials and younger generations is they want to do important work. They want to feel like what they do matters. And so one of the things that a good leader does is they help people see. I say your job and your work are two different things. Your job is what you do, but your work is why you do it. You know, and if you're a forklift driver for Scholastic Books, and I may have even shared this story when I spoke there 6 years ago, he's asked by the president of the company who's walking through the warehouse, what is your job here? And he says, my job is to help children learn to love reading. Well, his work, you know, is driving the forklift. But his job, and I may have actually reversed that here. I may have been dyslexic in my idea. But the point is, he saw the connection between losing a pallet or dropping a box of books and damaging books and the kid not falling in love with books. So we really need to, not because it's touchy-feely, but because it's important to people, we really need to find, we still need to reward them, but we need to find a way. I always say that inspiration is motivation of the power of purpose. Motivation of the power of purpose. And so you got motivation, but then you say, but you connect it to a greater purpose. And that's one of the great arts now, I think, of leading, especially younger generations. The second thing is going from an organization to a culture. I guarantee during COVID, when people were sheltering in place, the org chart mattered not.
Mm-hmm.
People did what they thought needed to be done because of the values and the training and the relationships and the blueprint that they had picked up both consciously and subconsciously from their work. And the big thing about culture is you either have one by design or you have it by default. So in the book, I wrote about how do you create a culture? And you've been at your company very, very deliberate, right? I mean, you know, onboarding, by the way, I have a friend who's in HR. He said the first day at work and the onboarding process does more to determine retention post 2 years than anything else.
And you know what, Mark? We have over 90% retention of our employees. The people who leave are people who probably, let's just say, need to leave, right? Like you can't be perfect in all of your hiring, but we have gotten phenomenal at it. Melissa Monroe, who literally is in the office next to me, is our head of people operations. And I've always said that one of her superpowers is her recruiting. She finds the people that are just great fits at the company, really fit with our culture, know their passion, know their purpose, and work here. You were so right about it. Now, that wasn't always the case, Mark. Completely transparent. When we were going through some growth spurts, we made the Inc. 500. You know what? The thing to do when look at when you make the Inc. 500 is guess what happens after that? Ouch! Because you typically grow so fast, you cut corners, and you don't apply the right hiring principles. So what we changed was when we looked at our core values, the five core values that we have at our company, we use a scorecard with every interview, and we score them and say, is this person, like one of our core values, you'd appreciate this, Mark, is caring. It's the first, actually, core value, caring. And they get a plus or a plus minus or a minus. And we do that for all five of the core values. And if there's a minus on any one of them by any one of the interviewers, they don't go to Hollywood. That's it. They don't move forward and don't advance. And it's been a game changer for us, as well as, again, just her ability to find really, really great people. We want to create a great culture, and that comes from the people. I mean, it says this, you say you start with the leadership, but if we don't hire people that are caring, are collaborative, are driven, are invested, and are dependable, all of our core values, they won't fit, and you'll see it, and it breaks it apart. People I'm worried about is this millennial generation. Because I don't know if they're doing the things that they get that energy from, or if they have found that, or how they're going to find that. I think a lot of them, you know, they want to be content creators. They want to be on, you know, YouTube or TikTok, or, you know, and create a bunch of content, build up a bunch of followers and generate ad revenue, other revenue. And well, that looks really maybe shiny or whatever. What are you doing with that content? I mean, Mark, you're so intentional. I mean, you wrote the book on intention. You're so intentional with what you're doing to advance people in their careers. How do people find their sense of purpose?
Well, it's an inside job. I think we live in an age where we too easily look for someone to do it for us, you know, and by the way, if you're a speaker or an author, and you need to understand, publishers publish books and bookstores shelve books, but authors sell books. And when you understand that process, you realize that even though there are the one trick ponies, right, the flash in the pan, successful anyone's, authors, lawyers, teachers, they do it. They do it with influence and support from others, but they take responsibility. A friend of mine was telling me about his nutritionist, and he said, you know, I hated her. I met with her every week, and then one week I loved her because I realized the reason I hated her is I wasn't doing the work. And once he started doing the work, he loved her. Mm-hmm. And so, A, you say, I really, and it may not happen in a week or a year or a few years, but you got to be intentional about saying, what's my long-term plan to doing what I really enjoy doing that isn't oppressive, that I get excited about waking up in the morning? And what are the steps between here and there to do that? So it goes back to that, know thyself. It goes back to the idea, imagine a life different than the one you've been living, and then over time start living it. I want to jump back before I forget. You know, you said something that is so important for people in leadership and companies, and that is culture creates growth, but growth is the enemy of culture. And you found that out. You talk about that because the very thing that enabled you to grow successfully started to morph into something different once you had grown. So there is a cautionary tale to all of us, and that is make sure that your growth doesn't destroy your culture. You can continue to grow. You just have to make sure that the culture does not become corrupt by the growth. One of the things in the book I talk about is I say one of the reasons we don't have good cultures is we don't hire for culture. We hire for fit and function. If you've got three accountants that are all equally skilled at accounting, you ought to hire the accountant, in the case of your company, who's the most caring, right? Because that's the number one value. You don't just say, well, you know what? I'm going to hire the one that's willing to work for a little bit less. You're going to get an accountant, and you're also going to get someone that is a detriment to the other people in the company who care.
Yeah.
Detriment to your culture. So I think it's so important. And finally, I just want to, because I'm kind of left brain and come full circle, the third shift is from experience to emotion. And, you know, when you say, I want this to be the best place you've ever worked, that is an emotional metric.
For sure.
Not, I want you to make more money than you've worked anywhere else. And Bain & Company, for years, has made a lot more money with their question than I've made with my question, the net promoter score, right? Would you recommend us to a friend or relative or colleague? And that's a good question. But I think the question, COVID and post-COVID, is are you happier you chose us than the alternative? And are you more successful because you work here than if you work somewhere else? And again, we didn't rehearse this, but that's exactly, and that's what I do. I just completed a huge quantitative research project, but there's value in anecdotal research.
Yeah.
And let's take a premise and see how many companies are using that. And the answer is a lot. A lot of the leaders who are successful get the importance of culture and inspiration and how people feel, both customers and employees. And that was, you know, that was the Reader's Digest. Well, I guess Reader's Digest isn't as, you get to be my age, you realize certain illustrations aren't as powerful. I guess that's the executive summary of the intention imperative. But those are the three big shifts. And that's going to be just as important going forward when we're done with this mess as it was before.
Intention Imperative is one of Mark's books. That's the newest book, isn't it?
It is.
I think with COVID, what I realized, I remember March 20th, there was a document on my hard drive called We Are Being Tested. And the document's called that because that was the first line of what I wrote to my team. It was our all hands meeting. And my message was, we're going to be tested this year. We're going to be tested as a team. We've been dealt a set of cards where everything is white. There's no faces, there's no numbers, there's everything has changed. The game has completely changed and we don't know what to expect. And I said that the commitment I will make to all of you so that you sleep well at night is one thing. If our company is ever at risk, I'll let you know. I'll let you know if it's even heading in that direction. So if you don't hear from me about that, sleep well. Your job's safe. And what you're doing is good. And of course, I didn't just stay silent. I let them know week after week, month after month, how we were doing. And we've had a phenomenal year, Mark, which is, I don't know if I want to say it's surprising because, you know, with marketing being marketing, oftentimes the department that gets cut dramatically is the marketing budget, you know, discretionary. And so maybe we're blessed that we're working with a lot of companies that marketing has become a revenue engine, and companies are recognizing that we need to invest more there and grow there because we get an ROI from that. I mean, there are certain companies, no doubt, like McDonald's and others, that really cut back on their advertising immediately. They're not clients of ours. But I'm just saying in B2C, there were certain businesses that it made no sense for them to keep spending money when people couldn't frequent their businesses because it was just shut down. But the companies that can continue to drive growth, you know, drove it. I would hope with someone like you, like, yeah, you love public speaking and you're phenomenal at it. You've written books on it and shared your wisdom on how to be on stage. You know, you, that's part of your content. So for you not to be able to do that, I'm so happy to hear that you are finding other channels and other venues to keep the inspiration, education that you're doing. And anybody can read your book any minute of the day. But my favorite form of Mark beyond the book is being with you. And when you were in front of our team and you walked out, stayed around for a couple hours afterwards and checked in with the team and then departed. And I asked the team, I go, what'd you think? And they're like, wow, you know, it moved a lot of people. And I saw the impact on the business. That was an interesting time, like you say, 6 years ago, because we had gone through all of that growth and cut some corners. And then talking to clients like you suggest, we found there's a lot of things that we need to improve. And we have done that. The company's better and stronger than it's ever been. What did you say? Growth is the, hit that again.
Growth is the enemy of culture.
Growth is the enemy of culture. Well, I hope we have addressed that. In terms of leadership, you don't need a title to be a leader. Title of your book. What advice do you have for people that don't have a leadership title, but have really great ideas and want to have an impact? How do they get their voice heard?
In the book, I've become a huge fan the older I got of William of Ockham, who authored Occam's Razor. He was like a 14th century clergyman. And today you hear Occam's Razor kind of paraphrased as make things as simple as possible, but no simpler. And that's easier said than done, because there's a fine line between simple and simplistic. But over the years, I've worked with a number of definitions of leadership. I believe any term you can't define, you can't really improve, right? And any term that isn't shared, if caring is a value there, everybody needs to understand how you define caring. What does it look like, right? And in the book, I say in the simplest, without being simplistic, definition of leadership is leaders make things better for themselves and others. And that's key. If you just make things better for yourself, that's called ambition. Nothing wrong with ambition. I'm fine with ambition. But leadership always serves the greater good. So the premise you don't need a title to be a leader is look for ways to make things better. And there's two ways to do that. One is the formal, you come up with an idea and you go to your manager, your director, whomever you report to, and you say, I've got a good idea. What do you think? Probably part of that is you then saying, and I'm glad to implement that good idea, because I've always found lots of people have good ideas, but few people are willing to implement the good idea.
Mm-hmm.
I say the difference between creativity and innovation, creativity is thinking and innovation is doing it. And then, number one, you come up with a good idea. You think it out, you flesh it out, you study, you do the research. You don't come off half-baked. You look for what will be the objections. And then you go to your manager and you say, here's an idea, I'd like to implement it. The second option is, that last time you tried that, you went to your manager and your manager's a control freak and or they want all the glory for themselves. So you just go ahead and do it. Now, I'm not talking about risking large amounts of money or violating, corporate protocol. I'm just saying fly under the radar. Even though it's an old cliche, it's a beautiful one. And that is, it's easier to ask forgiveness than it is to get permission. And by the way, you don't have to ask forgiveness if you don't screw it up when you do it. And if you just implement something, if you come up with a system that's better, an idea that works better, once it becomes seen, the worst thing you're going to get is a manager who complains that you didn't run it by them first, in which case you probably ought to start looking for a different manager at a different company, because that's just silly and irrational. So, and people say, okay, well, what do I make better? Well, ask yourself this. What's the one thing about working here that makes me nuts?
Mm-hmm.
What bugs me? Maybe it's a form that's ridiculously obsolete. Maybe it's a process that could be simplified. I, I mean, I don't know, you know, where our listeners work, but I years ago had to teach where I first started training. I worked for a public seminar company and I had to teach team building. And, you know, team building is a wonderful thing, but the thing I taught was so abstract, you know, it was academic and it talked about norming, forming, storming, conforming, and lots of other ing words. And it was boring. It bored me. So it was hard to make the audience excited. So I basically rewrote the course. I didn't ask anybody. I figured I got to teach it. As long as my evaluations are good, nobody's going to mind. And this was a long time ago, because as it happened, then I went to another public seminar company. We recorded it. And it was the number two instructional video. That's how long ago it was. For those of you that don't know what video is, it was the number two instructional video in the United States. And the only reason I tell that story isn't to brag, but to say that I thought, this sucks. I want to make it better. If I've got to be preaching it 6 hours a day, I want it to be fun for me, fun for the audience, and informative. And, wow. And that's, you know, I try to practice what I teach. And that's an example from the Wayback Machine of how I did that.
Yeah, I could talk to you for hours, Mark, man. I really miss you. And when I come out to Denver to see Anita on my team, I'll make sure we get together when this thing lifts. I want to share the last two slides of my onboarding deck, because what you said, I have worked this into the onboarding hour that I spend with every employee. I say to them this, let me tell you a story. A guy by the name of Reed Hastings walks up to the counter at Blockbuster and he turns in his copy of Apollo 13, and the gal behind the desk, she's not Fred, her name's Betty. That's the name that I use. I go, Betty sits there and says, that'll be $40. And this guy goes, $40? What are you talking about? And she says, yes, sir, it's $40 in late fees. He goes, why am I paying a late fee? I actually walked down the aisle and I saw three copies on the shelf. So I'm clearly not taking any business from you. I probably embellish the story a little bit. But I say, and then so this guy Reed says, I'm just blown away that you're going to charge me $40 in late fees. And she goes, sir, I don't make the rules. I just follow the rules. That's above my pay grade, because he asked for a discount. So Reed walks out, probably waves hello in the form of a middle finger back and says, I'll never go there again. And you know how the story ends. Reed goes on to start Netflix and literally puts Blockbuster out of business. And so I say to every new member of the team, if you ever feel like Betty, change the rule. Don't ever do anything in our company that would ever have one of our customers feel anything less than extraordinary service. And that's why you have the copy of Fred Factor in your onboarding kit, to read about what you should be doing. And they all get it. And we have changed policies or processes. They're empowered to do whatever they need to do for their clients, whether it's billable, non-billable, whatever the right thing is to do, make your client a hero. That's the mission of the company. So that's how I tell why you have a copy of Fred Factor in your onboarding box. So there you go, Mark. Thank you for your inspiration to me over 16 years ago. I love the fact that I can tell you just how the work that you've done is having an impact on our entire organization. And I welcome and so glad you're here on the podcast. I think you guys get it. I'm a big fan. And Mark's got a lot of great content in the forms of books. And if you have a conference or virtual event going on, give Mark, go to Mark's website and check out what he can do for you guys. He's had a profound impact on our business. I hope he can do the same for you. Thank you, my friend. Miss you. Look forward to seeing you when this lifts.
Well, the feelings likewise. The pleasure's been all mine, and it's been great to be with you on the podcast. Thank you.
You bet. That's going to do it, you guys, for this episode. I look forward to bringing folks like Mark. He's one of a kind, though, on the podcast, mixing it up a little bit for you. We'll be back next week with a regularly scheduled format of talking about marketing and marketing technology and driving growth. I hope you guys are doing great. I hope you are looking at fall. As you said, Mark, we've all been served scrambled eggs. You know what? Make an omelet. An omelet's a good thing to do. And that's going to do it for this episode. We'll catch you on the next one. Take care.
You've been listening to Demand Gen Radio, bringing you the top industry experts, thought leaders, authors, marketing technology firms, and senior marketing leaders from around the world to teach you the methods and technologies for high-performance marketing.